today we're going to discuss the book that you have recently published, Matt Kennard. And allow me first, before I introduce my colleagues and my friends, the speakers, I would like to introduce my friend Matt. Matt is a co-founder and chief investigator at Declassified UK, a news outlet investigating British foreign policy. He was a fellow at the CIJ, Center for Investigative Journalism, in 2014 to 2016. And he has worked as a staff writer for the Financial Times in Washington, D.C., New York, and London. He has also authored two other books, Irregular Army and Silent Coup, How Corporations...
I have known Matt for over 6 months right now. And Matt is a very special friend to me, not because he is a journalist, a colleague, because he is a human. He is one of the most humans I know. Matt called me after I lost my family in October 2023. And I thought, another journalist who wants to talk to me, to call me to have an interview or so. I was not very much interested. But then when he called me and he introduced himself, I realized that he only wanted to call me because he cared about me. Unlike many other journalists who just wanted to talk to me because they want to write a story or whatever. But he called me and he kept talking to me because he cared about me and he wanted to help me. Ever since we became friends, he came to my home and we became friends after that. And then I realized that this is one of the bravest journalists I've ever met in my life. He's someone who has been everywhere,
who traveled all around the world
to report the news
and to be brave reporting them.
So I'm very, very, very pleased today to be sitting next to you, Matt. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And this book, The Racket,
which he wrote,
it's the outcome of
all the trips
and the work that he has done all around the world.
And this event is
called A Rogue Reporter Against the American Empire. We'll talk a little bit about it. Then we have other two speakers, Loki. Every one of you know Loki. He's an amazing artist and political commentator. And Huda Amouri, co-founder of Palestine Action. So allow me first, Matt, to ask you, why did you write this book?
Oof, that's a big question. Well, to be honest with you, I feel like it's blowing the whistle on the media and the global system, because basically I was an unusual person to get into the Financial Times, because I actually didn't get into university originally. I didn't get the grades to get into any of the unis I applied for, and I got in through clearing on a course I didn't want to do. Anyway, it's a long story, but I quit and then I started again. But I didn't find journalism until the war in Iraq in 2003, when I was at Leeds and I was getting involved in activism. And then I started writing columns for the Leeds student newspaper, which was it actually reached like 20,000 to 30,000 students. And it was kind of a thrill to be writing columns that were read by that many people. And I was like, well, this is something I'm interested in. Then I started doing more investigations and I got a big story before I left about a lecturer who was a racist. He believed in a bell curve, which is this racist theory about different races being more and clever than others. But anyway, that kind of, when I did that story and that did get on the front pages of the national newspapers, I was like, well, I can write columns, but anyone can write columns about and give their opinion. But if you do investigative work, you can actually reveal new facts that no one can argue with, you know? So I got obsessed with investigative journalism as a way to change the world and reveal the truth. And then from that story, I got into Columbia University in New York. And I was unusual. I don't think anyone from Leeds or someone with the A-levels I got had ever been to Columbia. And then I was really disappointed by the experience I had there, because this is like one of the most elite journalism schools in the world. But all the reporters there, all the wannabe reporters were just super establishment friendly supporters of the US government and allied governments. And I thought, well, I still want to do journalism, but how do I do that in this context? And then, long story short, I worked for Democracy Now! In New York for a while, but I couldn't stay there because they didn't have enough money to pay me. And then I came back to London and I was like, well, maybe I won't be a journalist then, because I couldn't see how I could fit and do the journalism I wanted. And then I saw a traineeship for the Financial Times. I was like, okay, I'll apply for that. I won't get it. And then I got it. But I tell this story because I was an unusual person to get into the Financial Times. I shouldn't have got in. Like, the system usually filters out people like me by then. But when I went to the Financial Times, I was aware that I probably wasn't going to stay there. So I should collect as much information as I can while I'm in there to reveal how the system really works. Because you get access in at the FT that I'll never have again. I haven't had since I left. I was in Washington when in Obama's second term, and I was going into the White House when Obama was president. I was doing all that kind of stuff, and I was collecting information. And they sent me to Haiti to do the post-earthquake reconstruction story and stuff like that. And I knew I couldn't publish the truth about what I was seeing. So I collected all that information, and then when I left, that's what the book became. It was basically using all that information which I'd accrued through those years at the FT and actually telling the truth, filling in the blanks. Because the way the FT propagandizes the population, like the rest of the media, the mainstream media, is censorship by omission. So I was never lying when I was at the FT, but you knew there were certain things you couldn't say. And that book just reveals all the stuff you can say. And in fact, interestingly, most of that information comes from the WikiLeaks cables. So, because it's about the US, and the WikiLeaks cables, which were released in 2010 and 11, was basically the mechanics of the US empire just put out in the open. So I'd cross-reference all the reporting I did for the Financial Times with what I was reading, and I read. For example, I read every single cable that had been sent from Port-au-Prince in Haiti to Washington. I read every single cable that went from La Paz to Washington in the period as well, and constructed the truth. So that was why I wrote it. And interestingly, again, it was a lesson. There's many lessons I've learned just from being on the inside, but also on the outside as well. It's like how they managed to marginalize the truth and get it out of the public realm. Like the racket, when it was published, didn't get reviewed in any mainstream. Well, it got reviewed badly in The Guardian, but but it didn't get reviewed in the FT. And actually, I don't know if I should say this, but I had a friend at the FT who stayed on, and he said, I actually heard some people at the canteen talking about your book and saying we should write a hit piece. And then his friend said, no, the best thing to do is just to ignore it. And that's what they did. And that is the best way to marginalize opinions that you and facts that you don't want. Just ignore it. Don't get into a controversy. Don't get into even doing hit pieces. The best way to ignore it. And that's how it operates on this topic. But we see it, of course, with Gaza as well. So that's why I wrote the book, and I think that another reason I wrote the book is going around the world for the FT and also myself, after I left, because some of the work was done after I left, I just realized that it's impossible to understand the world we live in unless you understand the power of the US and the power of the US empire. Impossible. And we live, and it's basically the governing dynamic of international affairs. Yet it's a term that is basically can't be used in the mainstream media. So we have this insane scenario where you have the most powerful country in the history of the world, by far, militarily and other ways, but yet it's unmentionable in the mainstream media. You can talk about Russian imperialism or Chinese imperialism, but you can't get US imperialism. So we've got this whole system that is run by the United States that you can't talk about. So I think it's very, very important that people understand how that empire works.
Explain to me, Matt, what do you mean by the empire? You have been mentioning empire.
Okay, yeah, it's a good question. So there's an academic called Paul Kennedy who does comparative analysis of empires through history, and he writes that there's never been an empire as powerful as the United States. He said nothing even close. So the British Empire its army was smaller than a lot of European countries. Its navy, which was its biggest asset, famously, was two times as big as the following country. Whereas the US is just far out by itself. It has 800 military bases around the world that are official. There's others as well. It has carrier battle groups, 11 of them, which mean they can get anywhere in the world. It has bases everywhere in the world. It spends $800 billion a year on the Pentagon. There's nothing that's ever been like that. So, and it exerts its power, and it has powerful intelligence agencies like the CIA and others. And what they are about, it's called the Department of Defense, but what it's about is the Department of Imperialism. It's about projecting American power and projecting American corporate power. And everywhere I went, I was seeing that this empire exists in the shadows, but anywhere hope would rise up, that empire would come and smash it. And one of the longest chapter in the book is about Bolivia, which is a very, very interesting country. And what's happened there in recent history is very, very important. It's historic what's happened, because obviously the indigenous people of Latin America were wiped out, and some of the worst crimes in history were enacted on them. But and after 500 years, they elected in 2005 their first ever indigenous president, Evo Morales, who was a democratic socialist. He grew up in dirt poverty. Many of his siblings died in childhood. And he grew up, he became leader of the coca union, because he picked coca. That was his job. And he got to the presidency and was actually completely transforming the society. They nationalized huge amounts of industries. They kicked out the CIA. They kicked out the Drug Enforcement Administration. They kicked out US aid. And actually, the system is really, if you want to understand systems, I think the best way to understand them is when they stop working how they should. Now, all those agencies I mentioned, the US tells us, well, we're there because we don't want drugs. We're there because we want aid to get to Bolivians. But of course, it's all rubbish. What they are about is exerting American control. And when I went to Bolivia a couple of years after he was elected, and I did a whole investigation, which is in the book, about how the US was subverting the democratic government in Bolivia, this historic government. And that is replicated all around the world. We know the famous cases like Salvador Allende in Chile in 1973. It happened in Brazil in 1964 with President Goulart. So it's the American Empire is the most powerful tool for counter revolution, for reaction around the world. And it's really, really important we center it as this nefarious influence, because we live in a society where the narrative is set by mainstream media, corporate media, and think tanks. And think tanks are all funded by arms companies, NATO foreign ministries, all the rest of it. And what they project, and this goes from the left on the, well, so-called left on the Guardian to the right in the Telegraph, everyone always projects this idea of America being a beneficent power that is about spreading freedom and democracy. And in fact, you have to believe that to get a job in the mainstream media. You have to. There's no one who doesn't who's doing news reporting who doesn't believe that. And it's important we smash that completely. And of course, this becomes even more important when we consider what's happening in Gaza. I actually think that the U.S. empire has never been as exposed, because you're talking about Israel. Israel is a country of 9 million people, its GDP is smaller than Sweden.
We will come to Israel in a bit, but I really want to understand, why does the media, the Western media in the UK and in the US and all around the world, never mention anything of what you just said? The empire is never mentioned anywhere.
Because
the only one I heard from the empire is from you.
Yeah.
But why does the media doesn't cover that?
Because most of the media is corporate media, right? And corporations are effectively what the American empire is running for. So if you look at all the interventions of the CIA, the US military, whatever it is, they're always doing those things because they had their corporate, Washington's corporate interests are threatened. So you have a system which is run by corporations, the newspapers are, and they reflect the interests of those corporations. Another one is that all the people within those institutions are have gone through the elite institutions which indoctrinate them to believe this stuff. Like I mentioned Columbia University, right? If you go to Columbia, Harvard, wherever it is, all these elite universities, all your professors will be telling you this stuff. No one will tell you anything else. So, and it's a way of ideological training, so you're prepared for the corporate media. And in fact, it's interesting because my experience was I had a really critical analysis of what was happening, and I managed to maintain it through this kind of ideological training. But I definitely felt it at Columbia and the FT that there was so much pressure to just become part of that that way of thinking. And if you and the other thing is, of course, I had to leave. So if you don't want to leave, and no one does it consciously, no one's thinking I want to become a neoliberal US empire supporting journalist. No one wants to look in the mirror and see a monster. So what people do is they slowly, it's interesting how it works, they slowly just shave off their sharper edges. And that happens with everyone nearly. Because, and also there is also just very everyday things where people want to have a normal life, right? If you've got a mortgage, you've got kids, it's not really, there's not much appetite for just having a revelation that everything you're publishing is in support of a really violent empire, and then putting yourself completely outside of the job market. So there's many, many ways that happens. But when you start understanding that the people who we're meant to revere as the most intelligent people in our society are actually not there because they're the most intelligent, but they're the most willing to accept the myths that govern our society, that's quite an interesting revelation. And it goes for the US empire, but it goes for many, many, many other topics.
I think this all makes sense when we talk about Palestine in relation to the US empire. And you have a chapter in this book about Palestine. So tell me, how did visiting Palestine, you told me before that you visited Palestine, and visiting Palestine, it changed your life in a way.
Yeah.
Tell me more about this chapter and how visiting Palestine changed your life.
Yeah, actually, that was before I was at the FT. I went with the International Solidarity Movement, which is a great, I don't know if it still exists, but it was or is a great organization which was set up by two people to help Palestinians non-violently resist Israeli occupation forces, I did the training in London. I went out to the West Bank and lived there. And I mean, I think if you talk to anyone who's been to Palestine, everyone says they come back changed, because you can't see apartheid up close and not be deeply affected by it, because all the propaganda just evaporates instantly, because you're surrounded by walls, you're surrounded by fences, you're surrounded by violent soldiers, you're surrounded by settlements which sit up on hills overlooking Palestinian villages, and you just realize it's the worst thing in the world, you know. And it's and Desmond Tutu went to the West Bank I don't know, 15 years ago or so, and he said it's worse than what we have in South Africa, and I think that's true. Andrew Feinstein, who was activist against apartheid South Africa, he says the same thing. So it's impossible to see that and not just think that apartheid is the worst that humans can do. So going there had a massive effect. I mean, the other side of it is also that it really rammed home the difference between what we're fed in the West and the reality, because there's no space for the propaganda I stayed with a family in Sheikh Jarrah, actually. Sheikh Jarrah is a Palestinian part of East Jerusalem that is being Palestinians are being evicted to make way for settlers, it was just a deeply painful experience to live with this family. They had two kids, a mum and a dad. They'd lived there since the 50s, the family, and they were getting evicted by the Israeli authorities based on a forged contract. And then I was reading the papers, and either it wouldn't exist or they'd be taking the Israeli line. And I was just like, this doesn't get worse than this as a moral issue. But then we got a media that's just supporting the oppressors. So I knew, I think that it's never, of all the places I've been, Palestine's the clearest of who the oppressor is and what we can do about it. And yeah, it had a huge impact on me. And I went back actually some years later, again to the West Bank, and the house that I lived in with this Palestinian family had it was behind a massive barrier, and it just had a massive Israeli flag on, so they'd been turfed out and made way for settlers. So yeah, it's huge. And then obviously fast forward into now, I think that it's how the last 8 months has had a huge impact on me and everyone in this room, I imagine. Like you can't watch that for 8 months and not be deeply, deeply affected, and not have a massive evaluation of your worldview and how and your theory of change and what we can do to stop the atrocities. And of course, it's I'll finish with this, but it's intimately involved with the US embargo, because as I said, like, Israel's a small country, it couldn't operate for a week without the United States. 80% of its weapons come from the United States. All the diplomatic support, you got Biden in the White House just repeating all their lies. Israel has exposed the American empire like never before, I think, because the US empire operates, as I say, on these myths about spreading freedom, democracy and human rights. But we've watched the last 8 months of genocide and the White House supporting it to the hilt, even more than some parts of the Israeli political society as well. So we need to locate the US empire as the main enemy. We need to work out how we fight it. And that's another thing maybe we could talk about later or now, is the impact, the role it has in our society as well, because there's a chapter in the book about the US empire in Britain. And when I was reporting most of the racket, I was going to the developing world and the third, what's called the Global South now, and seeing weak states being dominated by the US, like Haiti being an emblematic example. And I thought, okay, well, that's kind of I understood that was happening. But then I started looking when we started Declassified UK about the US power here against a strong state. And I actually think the US has even more of a stranglehold over this country. And since 1945, we've never, like, Labour leaders is, conservatives have always supported being Atlanticists, but in terms of Labour, which is the main focus of the CIA's efforts over the years, there's only been two non-Atlanticists, which means two non-pro-American imperial project leaders of the Labour Party since the Second World War, and that's Michael Foot from 1980 to 83 and Jeremy Corbyn from 2015 to 2020. And that, I realised when I started doing the work I did for Declassified, that is not a coincidence. Mm. The US has been interfering in our political system in nefarious and covert ways for decades and decades. And in fact, Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State, was then Secretary of State in 2019, but he was formerly the head of the CIA from 2017 to 18 under Trump. He came to London and was recorded saying privately, it might be the case that Jeremy Corbyn becomes Prime Minister. This is 6 months before the election. You should know, he's told his audience, we won't let that happen, and we'll be working to stop it happen. We don't know what that activity was, but it goes to show that the US is working all the time to stop liberation in our country and to stop us having a leader that represents a sovereign country. And the other thing is, we have 12,000 American troops in this country, over 12,000, across 11 RAF bases that aren't RAF bases, they're US Air Force bases. We're not allowed to know what happens on them. The NSA, one of the chief US intelligence agencies, runs GCHQ, which is our largest intelligence agency site in Cornwall, called GCHQ Bude. So it's just, it's impossible structurally for us to elect a leader that actually represents us in terms of foreign policy, represents peace, justice, because the US has a stranglehold on our political system. And again, completely silent, completely secret. You can't know about this. I've done all, even at Declassify, we're a small sort of independent media outlet, and we've done all the work on the US influence here. For example, that figure I told you about 12,000 troops, I don't think that's ever been reported in the mainstream media. You would think that it would be quite interesting to the British public, that there is 12,000 troops. Many people here might not even know that. Yet you can't hear it in the mainstream media. So we have this invisible empire. And the part of the reason is people see what's happened to the one journalist who actually exposed the US empire like never before, and that's Julian Assange. And he's been in Belmarsh Maximum Security Prison for over five years now. Persecution by the US, but complicity of the British authorities. So we need to follow his example and understand that we need the truth about what the US does, away from the think tanks, away from the mainstream media, and it's an ugly truth.
Thank you very much, Shloki. I would like to hear what you think of what Matt just said, a lot of things that might be in your area of interests, because mm-hmm. you have done a lot of work on the media, who finance the media, who runs the media, the people who run the media, like behind the scenes. So what do you think of all of that, what Matt just said? And also another thing, how critical do you think the American support for Israel is?
So, full disclosure, I am on the board of advisors for Declassified UK, so have had a good vantage point to see how it's developed from the beginning, and that has been great. In terms of what Matt is speaking about, I think it works in several ways. So, what also happens, in addition to the invisibilizing of 12,000 soldiers on what is quite a small landmass, is also the amazing case of a teenage British citizen by the name Harry Dunn, who was on his bike when a car came out of a US base driving on the wrong side of the road. Inside the car was Ansar Kulas, what has now been revealed to be a CIA agent on British soil. She drove the car into Harry Dunn and killed him. Right? Now, what happened next is very illustrative of the relationship between Britain and the United States. You had an individual within the British Foreign Office text Sekulas that it was best to leave the country as soon as possible. And so within about 48 hours, Ansar Kulas was on a plane to the United States. And since then, the family of Harry Dunn have been doing everything they can to try and extract some form of some semblance of justice from this intransigent system. And what you actually saw happen was at one point Trump invite the family of Harry Dunn to the White House to talk to them about the case, the killing of their son. And do you know what happened? Trump said to them, you know she's next door. You know that Ansar Kulas is next door. Can you meet her? Right? So in a way, all of that, it illustrates a few things. Number one, Britain works for the United States within British borders. Yeah, it facilitates. That's what part of Five Eyes membership is. That's what it denotes. It facilitates the spying of its own population for the United States. It facilitates that process. But in this case of Harry Dunn, what you actually have is British attempts to protect the killers of a British citizen.
Why?
Because the relationship is so uneven and imbalanced. And, you know, I mean, you look at Kenya, it's just been reported that there's over 2,000 women in Kenya who have accused British soldiers of rape. And there seems to have been children born from these situations. So you have this this baked in unaccountability, really, of that relationship. And it also extends to so many other aspects. You think about Grenfell, right? It's not associated with US corporatism killing people in this country. In fact, quite the opposite. It's explained to the British population as undeserving foreigners having, quote-unquote, subsidised housing in the Queen's Royal Borough of Kensington, when actually what it is people that should have a certain level of rights within this society having their lives taken away because of US corporations writing the regulations that are supposedly there to police their activity in the country. You know, you look at Arconic, this is such an important company in terms of US global reach. It's involved in the F-35 project, which has been just a complete bonanza of profit to all of the worst people in the world. It's the company that is responsible for Grenfell, along with a few others. But that's so far from people's perception. You know, a few years ago, there were people gesticulating and militating relentlessly on a phrase like White Lives Matter. Where was Harry Dunn? Where was Harry Dunn? Anywhere near that conversation? And in fact, that in and of itself tells you what that is a reflection of. It's an astroturfing of ideas that come from a specific orientation politically. So there's a lot, obviously, to what Matt is saying here that needs to be looked more closely at. One of the examples that always strikes me as actually hilarious in terms of this relationship which you allude to between the media and these forces of domination is that simultaneous to the NATO occupation of Afghanistan, which rendered Afghans statistically the saddest people in the world, you had the deputy head of foreign affairs at Sky News simultaneously, no, she was the head of foreign affairs, the head foreign correspondent at Sky News, simultaneously an advisor to the deputy commander of NATO. At what point, you know, we have to begin to talk about this as at what point does British, Israeli and US intelligence begin and end? It's a trilateral security state, and the media, which we rely on for a lot of our information, is an attachment of it. And so I think, you know, it's important that Matt's book kind of will pave the way partly for us making, generalizing more of that understanding in terms of what is how pivotal is US support to Israel. Let's be clear, in this war, according to The Intercept, put out this revelation that there were US Air Force officers in the theaters with the Israeli, in the operating rooms with Israeli personnel for target acquisition. You've had the Reaper drone off the top of Gaza. Whatever they tell you about the purpose of the Reaper drone, its speciality is target acquisition. Okay, you have the Shadow R1 plane off the top of Gaza. One of its specialities is target acquisition. When you look at literally day by day, the key thing to watch is the ships and the planes. Don't listen to what is being said on a political level. All of that is PR. That's PR. What's happening on a military to military basis is the thing to watch as much as possible. And in this case, we have seen daily, tons and tons of weapons being sent by the US to Israel. You obviously have the secret warehouse in the Naqab that has US weapons from long, long time ago that Israel has absolutely free access to use when it wants. It's just a difference in strategy, but it's not a difference in objective. From time to time. So you'll see some of that come out, which the US will say, well, in order to roll out this particular PR exercise that we need to, you know, the most disgusting part of this, and again, it points to this sort of collaborative or more stenographer kind of relationship that often the media has, they'll be putting out this big scoop that Biden is furious with Netanyahu. Mm. You see absolutely none of that reflected in anything that Biden says or does vis-a-vis Netanyahu. And so it's constantly leaking these things to try and manage people's perceptions of this killing on an industrial scale. But, you know, overall, I think both the United States, Britain and Israel have been shocked by the power of the resistance in the region, by the willingness of people to keep fighting and to actually define the parameters of both Israel, the United States and Britain's logic in the region. Just so we get a full grasp of how Britain is servicing this process, is early on when the Yemeni armed forces took the first ship they took. It was a ship belonging to a company by the name Zodiac Maritime. Now, Zodiac Maritime is a British registered company owned by the Offer family, the richest family, Israeli family. Now, historically, what was revealed is that Zodiac Maritime and the Offers were operating as a front for Israeli intelligence in the region. Zodiac Maritime had been essential in assassinations that had been carried out, particularly Mabhouh in Dubai, when he was killed by Israeli agents who used fake British passports. They went on a ship that is a British registered company. So at that point, the British have to show some type of response because you've carried out this assassination in Dubai using fake British passports. So people were expelled from the country. We don't know to what extent people were expelled, but people were expelled. But yet the company still operates. It still operates from here freely, despite the fact that within the Times newspaper, that bastion of the British establishment reveals that this company is a front for Israeli intelligence, yet it still operates here. It clearly doesn't have any respect for its own sovereignty. There's many ways that we can talk about Britain having zero regard for its own sovereignty when it comes to the issue of Israel. Mm. Obviously, the United States goes without saying, but the Israel factor is definitely something that can be explored. But my just last point on that is that the company that is tasked with protecting Zodiac Maritime's operations is an offshoot of the British Ministry of Defence. Yeah? So we're talking about levels of British involvement in this machinations in the region, which is not focused on anywhere near enough. We spend way too much time looking at what politicians say rather than looking at actual material infrastructure. The more we start looking at actual material infrastructure, we start seeing that actually, you know, and the British particularly have been so good at cultivating this impression of noble intentioned incompetence to cover up for actual material imperialism. And unfortunately, the more optimistic among us, we stay in that space of discussion where there's some type of hiding underneath it is some type of conscience that can be appealed to, you know, and they have the long tradition of Arabists in the Foreign Office that go to SOAS and learn Arabic and then come out of it and speak in places like the Frontline Club and go on the BBC and BBC Arabic and the rest of it. And so they do a good job. You know, they do a good job of convincing people that there is even worth a conversation worth having. A conversation worth having. Really, really, this period needs to make absolutely clear that if you're sitting with representatives of the British government, you're sitting with Israel. Yeah. You're sitting with Israel. The line needs to be drawn here, and we need to be clear about that. And so, as far as I see it, what else has been proven by this period of time, not only that we have to concentrate on the material infrastructure that is built up around this, that direct action is the only thing that works in this country. Palestine Action has shut down three sites of Israel's largest arms company in this country.
Okay, we will come to Huda about that.
But first, let me say that I asked you how critical the American support for Israel is. While a few months ago, I hosted Huda and Andrew Feinstein to talk to them about the bomb that killed my family. Mm. And Andrew Feinstein told me that the bomb that was dropped on my family and killed 21 members of my family, including 14 kids, was an American-made weapon, American-made vehicle, an American-made bomb. But it's not also the U.S. who made the bomb. It's also the U.K. participated in manufacturing this bomb and part of the F-35. So let's go to where you ended, Matt, to Huda. I will ask you this question again and again and again. Why did you start Palestine Action? And you also have recently expanded to the U.S. So tell me why you started Palestine Action and why did you expand to the U.S.?
Yeah.
What did you do in the U.S.?
Yeah, well, personally, I didn't start Palestine Action alone, but personally, for me, I've been involved in Palestine campaigning for many years before taking direct action to the level I was doing when we started Palestine Action. And it was really an evolution throughout my campaigning. And, you know, I started off at university and I was exposing the university's links to Israeli apartheid and, you know, campaigning for them to divest. And then I was talking to other student groups and doing these kind of things across the country, exposing how pension funds were investing billions of pounds in the arms trade. And I think when I began, I was quite naive and optimistic. I'm still optimistic, but maybe more naive back then, because I really believed, well, if I show these institutions the facts, the reason, and the proof, and their own policies, and point out the hypocrisies, and build a campaign, then this is going to be easy, and they're going to divest. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you do this for a number of years, and you get to a point when you realize you keep asking the same institutions or, you know, at one job I worked for, at one point I was working for an NGO on Palestine, and part of that involved lobbying MPs. And I would lobby 70 MPs and ask them to impose an arms embargo on Israel. And every time you're doing these things, you feel like you're banging your head against a brick wall. And, you know, if we would get some victories along the way, some minor things here and there, some small divestment from companies, but nothing matched the severity of the complicity with the colonization of Palestine. And, you know, I'm not campaigning for the liberation of my people just for the sake of campaigning. I want us to be victorious. I want us to win. And so when you see that the institutions that you're appealing to are completely compromised, and especially the timing, Palestine Action launched in 2020. So for me personally, for other people, they had different motivations, but it was a crucial time because it was, you know, the downfall of Jeremy Corbyn. And during Corbyn's time in 2019, I remember that manifesto was the first time I'd seen it anyway, that an arms embargo between the UK and Israel was on the Labour Party manifesto. So that was very exciting. And then obviously we saw him be completely crushed. And with that came the realization that, you know, we got quite close at that point in time. And if they are not going to impose an arms embargo on Israel, then we have to do it ourselves. And doing it ourselves means taking direct action and going to the companies, the Israeli weapons companies operating in this country and shutting them down time and time and time again. And if that meant getting arrested in order to do so, then it meant getting arrested. But actually, for me personally, and I think for a lot of people, it was extremely empowering to actually take direct action. And it seems counterproductive because you're going to get arrested and have your liberty taken away from you. But actually, when you climb on top of an arms factory, an Israeli weapons factory, and, you know, you have a hammer in your hands and you have paint and you can completely destroy this Israeli weapons factory and they are powerless to stop you, then you realize just how much of an effect you can have. And so Palestine Action really was born out of a necessity to take direct action, out of the political road for change when it comes to this country's complicity with Palestine being closed off. And so that's why I started Palestine Action in 2020.
And we also heard that there is a recent expansion to the US. Mm. Tell me more about it.
Yes, well, we've been going for several years, and after October 7th, we've been speaking to groups all across the world for quite a long time. But after October 7th, something changed globally, and people in the US wanted to get involved in taking direct action and launch Palestine Action US, which was a very important development, because, you know, Britain, we have so many Israeli weapons factories. When we started, there were 10 Israeli weapon sites, 10 sites that belonged to Elbit Systems, Israel's biggest weapons firm. And in terms of topping that number, you know, the US tops that number by quite a significant amount. So taking direct action in the belly of the beast is crucial. And so it is an important development, and I think one that needs to continue to grow and expand. We're also seeing now Palestine Action launching in Australia, all across Europe, you know, Italy, France, so many different countries, because people all over the place are saying, I think in this, since October 7th, people have become radicalized in a very short period of time, in the sense that they went out to the protests for the first few months. They saw the International Court of Justice ruling, and all of these international institutions, which were told are supposed to, you know, are supposed to be able to impose some sort of accountability on Israel. And people are realizing the futility of these institutions and the futility of appealing to the same government and to the same establishment. And so we're seeing this across the world now, where people are taking direct action regardless of the risks, because really we cannot compare the risks that we face here or even in the US or across, you know, the Western world, when we are seeing the consequences of what these weapons do to Palestinians. And Ahmed, you talked about the bomb that killed your family. And one thing that I was listening to after that podcast was Elbit Systems had an annual investor conference, and it was in he was speaking in Hebrew. They're doing it in Israel, and they're much more upfront about what their weapons do when they're speaking in Israel. And in 2021, during the bombing of Gaza in May 2021, they called it the first artificial intelligence war, because Elbit Systems were using artificial intelligence drones and for the first time. And this is what Elbit do. They use attacks on Gaza as an opportunity to develop their weapons, which they will market as battle-tested on the Palestinian people. In this most recent investor conference, he talked about how this time, they're calling it the first digital war, because they're building the systems that will connect the different weaponry to one system to basically make it more efficient to commit genocide in Gaza. And so, you know, that's just another development that we're seeing from Elbit Systems, and also how they are openly saying about how they want to use the ongoing genocide as an opportunity to prove the new weaponry that they want to sell across the world. But I have to say, at the same time as that, when we saw in 2014 during the bombing of Gaza, that Elbit's share price went through the roof, because this is normally what happens to arms companies. When they can show how their weapons are working, they make more sales, they're selling more to the Israeli military. But this time, their share price is tanking. It's going down for the first time in quite a while, quite significantly, which just shows that actually, you know, the direct action across the world and the disruptions that they're facing is quite significant. And so this is a turning point.
So the British government is telling you that taking direct action against these factories that produce planes and bombs that killed 15,000 children in Gaza is illegal. The planes and the bombs that destroyed all the homes, 70% of the homes in Gaza, all the universities, most of the hospitals, the planes and the bombs and the weaponry that destroyed Gaza and turned it into ashes, the UK government is saying that it is illegal to take direct action against them. What do you say to them?
Well, I mean, when you think you answered the question by asking it, because it's so ridiculous, this concept. And this is the point of taking direct action: when things don't make sense anymore, when facilitating and arming a genocide is seen as legal, but taking direct action to stop a genocide is seen as illegal, then I'd much rather be seen as doing something which is illegal. But arguably, we would say that we are upholding international law. It couldn't be any more clearer. I mean, when you have these factories are built, and the whole basis of Elbit Systems, the whole business model, is based on the destruction of Palestine, the genocide of Palestinians, the occupation of Palestine. We know that this is illegal under international law. So that whole business model is based on criminality. So by taking that down, we are upholding international law. We are upholding morality. But we can see it more and more when they try and make arguments that value the property of the banks that invest in Elbit Systems or the factories which are building the weapons to massacre Palestinians. And they will try and argue, this is the corporate media as well, will try and argue that this is more valuable than Palestinian lives. And when that is the argument that's being made, then, you know, that it's never more clear that we need to take down these weapons factories. We need to take down these institutions which are upholding the genocide. And there is absolutely no shame in it. And it's completely the essential step, you know, now more than ever before. And just to go back about the corporate media, because Palestine Action just last week took action against around 20 Barclays branches. Barclays invest in Elbit Systems. And interestingly, The Guardian allowed the CEO of Barclays to have an opinion article discussing his thoughts, being able to criticize us about taking action against him. This is the CEO of Barclays in The Guardian. And, you know, we wrote to The Guardian and said, well, okay, can we have an opinion article now, please? And went, no. no thanks, no thanks. We've got too much going on at this period of time.
Allow me to go back to you, Loki. It's clear that you have been a target of the Israeli lobby in the UK. Can you tell me a little bit about the Israeli lobby, how it works in the UK, and how can we challenge the Israeli lobby in the UK?
I mean, I'd be insulted if I wasn't. I expect more. But one point, I have a slightly different analysis of the last question that you asked. The current head of the police, Mark Rowley, is actually subject to what is a coup attempt, a long coup attempt. It has the involvement of the JNF proxy, the CAA, who, of course, had such a party under Corbynism. They were able to smear who they wanted, when they wanted, and able to dictate, essentially, to the Labour Party who to expel and who not to. Now, they have a little bit of a circle which they're struggling to square when it comes to Palestine Action. Now, what Huda pointed to precisely is that contradiction whereby Britain, as a signatory to the Arms Trade Treaty, if it has reason to believe that exports may be used for violations of international humanitarian law, it should not make that export, right? Okay. Now, when you take a case like Palestine Action into the court system, you have several different levels that Israel, essentially, because let's be clear, you know, one of the recent trials, you had an individual who was meant to come and testify against Palestine Action that Elbit said he's so essential to the war effort, we cannot send him. So that's how we're talking about Israel. We're talking about Elbit Systems, we're talking about the Israeli government, right? So what we also saw, interestingly, the Guardian legal department published it, was that the Israeli embassy sought to lobby the CPS on Palestine Action cases, right? Sought to directly intervene in the legal process. Of course, a great affront to sovereignty, which everyone supposedly cares about. But on this particular issue here now, you have to get through, number one, the jury. Then you have to get through, first you have to get through the police. Then you have to get through the CPS. Then you have to get through the jury. Then you have to get through the judge. They cannot fast track that system because at each point there are preventions from these being pushed further. Make no mistake about it. As far as Elbit Systems is concerned, she should be in prison now. So should I probably, right? Ultimately, that's what they want the British government to do. There is something holding that back. There's something that is preventing that from happening. So what I believe is that Mark Rowley is subject to a coup attempt, which is now even encompassing Tommy Robinson as well, because they are not, and yes, they're arresting people for signs at protests. Okay, that's part of some form of pre-agreed situation where they're trying to apply the IHRA in those cases. But from Suella Braverman to other Israeli assets in this country, they have sought to pressure the police and the CPS to apply a IHRA in legal cases. And it's happening bit by bit, but it's not very convincing. And so once you then bring those people into court, you have to convince a jury and then you have to convince a judge. So it's those type of protections, really, that have allowed Palestine Action to achieve what it has achieved and to have operated for these years. Where this will go next, we'll see. I think I need to rewind a bit to what your actual question was. It was about the Israel lobby.
Yeah.
I mean, to be honest, there's nothing particularly exciting or exceptional about it. It's the same rubbish that they mobilize against other people. They look for places they feel you are vulnerable and they try to strike in those places. It's a maximalist, top-heavy movement. When you look at Zionism, it is historically been simultaneously top-heavy and granular in its approach. And that actually has led to the hubris which has put it in the situation it's in now. It's terrible. Terrible at grassroots operations. Even if you look at the case of the Iraqis that eventually left Iraq to become Israelis, right? The emissaries that would write back to the Zionist movement about the Iraqis, they'd say, ah, yes, this is strong human material. The exact words that were used by the Zionist emissaries at that time. This is strong human material. It's different from the type of human material that you have in Eastern Europe, because in Iraqi society, these are people who have prospered and are doing well. Okay. They were so ineffective at convincing Iraqi Jewish people to become Zionists that they had to cultivate Tawfiq al-Suwaidi, an Iraqi politician, and they were cultivating him literally from the 30s. To with this idea of population exchange and population transfer, where you take Iraqis from Iraq and put them in Palestine, to where they become Israeli, and you take Palestinians and you put them in Iraq and they become Iraqis, right? That he passed something called the denaturalization law in 51, which would supposedly allow Iraqis to leave Iraq and become Israelis, right? It was such a failure that in the first month, there were under 10 people that took him up on that offer. What then happened, and Avi Schleim has done some work recently, but there's Abbas Shiblaq has the amazing book, The Lure of Zion. Israel's fledgling external intelligence agency at that time, which had help from the United States, which had some help from the British as well, would plant bombs at synagogues in Baghdad. And that led to Iraqi Jews leaving and become in line with that Denaturalization Act. That's quite a long-winded way of me trying to explain that they are very, very top-heavy. They focus on the top of institutions, and they focus on subjugating those institutions. What they don't excel at, never have, in any context, maybe in the former Soviet Union, the cultural push. And somebody like me is like quite kind of uniquely positioned in that sphere where I haven't had to be on a major label. Yeah, because there's mechanisms within, and we could get into that also, where in the major labels there are mechanisms to minimize this type of support for the Palestinian cause. But ultimately, they tried to lobby a company, which was Spotify. We were able to get people that are worth a lot more to Spotify and masses of people on our side against them, and they failed. They failed. But the lesson from it is the same lesson from Palestine Action. It's the same lesson from Matt Kennard's career. If you don't fight back, you will always lose. If you do fight back, you might not lose, but the only way you will ever win is if you fight back. They will silence people that ultimately want to be silenced on some level. And we've seen a perfect example in our attempt to use the Labour Party as a vehicle for actual social change in this country. Yeah? If you do their bidding, as Winston Churchill said, he said, an appeaser is somebody that feeds a crocodile in the hope that the crocodile will eat them last.
Thank you very much. Let me take that back to Matt. You've been waiting patiently, Matt. Thank you very much. We've talked a lot about Zionism, and I remember a few weeks ago we did a podcast for Palestine Deep Dive. They asked you, what does Zionism mean to you? And then you answered. And that clip got millions of views, 1.5 million views on Instagram for a small platform for Palestine Deep Dive. And this made me feel like people really want to hear about Zionism. And now it is the time that we talk about Zionism and we try to dismantle Zionism. Tell me more about this. Why do you think people want to hear and know more about Zionism?
Well, I'll come to that. But firstly, I think now is the time to talk about it because there's an opening, right? We were talking about it before. There's two things I think that we need to talk about now. One is the Israel lobby and one is Zionism. And they've been red lines for many people for too long. And that protects the Israeli state. Even organizations which are pro-Palestinian or whatever, and do good work, they won't touch those two issues. And like Huda says, we're not in it because we just for fun and games, we want to win. And unless we combat those two things, we won't win, because Zionism has been had one of the biggest PR campaigns in history attached to it. Let's get rid of all that and look at what Zionism is. It's an ideology which ethnically cleansed 800,000 people from Palestine in 1948. It put those people in little bits of territory like Gaza and the West Bank. It put them under military rule, It means that the Palestinians, that the indigenous people that stayed, the Palestinians that stayed, have to stay a permanent minority, because Zionism is all about a Jewish state. It will stop being a Jewish state if those Palestinians outbreed the Jewish population. This doesn't sound like anything to do with progressive politics to me. But yet the way the Zionist adherents and proponents have presented Zionism is some progressive ideal that we should all support if you believe in human rights and all this stuff. It's the opposite. And we shouldn't be scared to talk about it, because if we're scared to talk about it, we're doing their bidding. And we should... you asked me in that interview, actually, you said, is there anything good about Zionism? I said, no. I said, if you'd asked me, is there anything good about Manifest Destiny, which was the ideology which the British used to destroy the Native Americans, no, I don't have anything good to say about that. Why would I have something good to say about Zionism? It's a settler colonial ideology. It's about racism, it's about supremacism, and... Yeah, in the final part, the final chapter, it's about genocide. So I think that Zionism is massively misrepresented, and it's a precondition for climbing up in institutions in our society, and that's why it has such power. Because I don't know, is there an anti-Zionist MP in the whole of in Britain? Probably not. George Galloway. Okay, so we got one, and he was only just recently elected. So, how can you have a, when I've described what that ideology means, and yet you have a parliament of hundreds of MPs, and not one of them is against it. So, and that's because it's a protected part of this debate, and it should no longer be. And we do have an opening. I say things now, which would have got a lot more pushback. In fact, and you mentioned that video, millions of views, right? That wouldn't have got millions of views before and would have been subject to intense attacks. There weren't even that many attacks. There were the usual sort of bots, but there weren't that many attacks because they know it's indefensible. So we need to breach that. And the other one that just I'll mention as well is the Israel lobby, because as Loki's talked about, like, they have a huge amount of power over our institutions and the top of our institutions. And when it's exposed, it's indefensible. And the way they get around the way they marginalize the debate is they make anyone who talks about it present them as an anti-Semite or a conspiracy theorist and all this stuff. And okay, look, if you're in it for status or you want to rise up, or fine, I can understand why you play the game. You don't want to be called those things. But if you're in it to win it, then you have to expose it and not care that you're going to get called these nasty names. And in this country, just to carry on from what Loki said, just to give you an example of the power of the Israel lobby in this country. So Alan Duncan, who was foreign minister from 2016 to 2019, he wrote a memoir a couple of years ago. And Alan Duncan is quite an interesting character, because he's one of the most awful establishment figures in politics, in my opinion. He's no longer in politics, but he's one of the Arabists that Loki talks about in the Foreign Office. So he's got awful politics on everything. He's an oil man. He's close to all the Gulf dictators, but he is quite decent on Palestine. And when I say decent, he supports the official government position. But that makes you a radical within the Conservative Party and within the British state. And he was the target of a massive campaign by the Israel lobby. And it came out in an Al Jazeera documentary when a diplomat at the embassy was recorded saying he wanted to take him down. And that diplomat actually had to resign and leave the country. Now, he talks about in that book about a time when Boris Johnson was the foreign secretary. He was his junior minister. And Boris Johnson was like, I want to appoint you a minister for the Middle East. And Alan Duncan was like, okay, that's good. I'm up for that. And then he gets a call from, I think it was from Boris Johnson, saying Conservative Friends of Israel, which is a front group for the Israeli embassy. They don't reveal their funders. But if you look at the relationship between that embassy and Conservative Friends of Israel, it also goes for Labour Friends of Israel. They're extremely close. He gets a call saying, oh, look, CFI, Conservative Friends of Israel, Stuart Polak or Eric Pickles, I can't remember, they're two senior members of it. They've called up Theresa May, who was then Prime Minister, and said, you can't appoint Alan Duncan Middle East Minister. because of his position on Palestine. So you've got an Israel lobby group calling up the prime minister, arguably, allegedly the most powerful person in the country, and saying you can't do it. What does Theresa May do? She says, okay, if CFI say I can't, I can't. And it goes back to Boris Johnson. And there's a funny bit in the book where they're talking about, they have a conversation after they've heard that the prime minister no longer wants to appoint him. And Alan Duncan's pleading with Boris Johnson saying, look, what about you just appoint me Middle East minister, but you don't include Israel-Palestine in the brief? And then that might work. Like, this, it's insane that, that they're talking this way. And then, and they put that idea and that gets shot down. In the end, he's appointed to be minister for the Americas. Which he does for 3 years. What I've just described is an outrage. If you believe in British sovereignty, if you believe in democracy, right? This is a pressure group which represents an apartheid state, a genocidal state, which is overruling our prime minister. That story has never been mentioned in the mainstream media, and that's how they get away with it. Because what they do, the Alan Duncan book, how the reaction of that in the, I think it's actually one of the best exposés of the Israel lobby in this country that's ever come out, because it's an insider's account. If you look at how that was covered in the mainstream media, it was all about a tittle-tattle, you know, like Boris Johnson called Eric Pickles a fat idiot or something like that, you know, like all this kind of stuff that the Daily Mail and stuff would cover. No one covered the fact that we're getting overruled by an Israel lobby group. So again, we need to breach that that red line as well, because that protects them. Because it's not conspiratorial, it's not anti-Semitic. Most countries have lobbies in this country of differing power. Israel is actually extremely powerful, and we should say that openly. And unless we start analysing it. And as Loki does a lot of this, which is great, like analysing the different groups which don't present themselves as anything to do with Israel, but are in fact working on behalf of Israel, we're not going to win. And also the other thing is, Loki mentioned about how they pick people off, you know, and choose who to expel. And I think that a lesson of the Corbyn era is that you can't appease these people. It's not like you can just say, okay, we'll get rid of him or her. And then they'll be all right. They don't step back after that. They say, we want another one. We want another one. We want another one. So what you do is you've got to fight back, and you've got to call them out, because they use the language of anti-Semitism. But what they do makes anti-Semitism much worse and makes anti-Semitism much harder to fight, because they're muddying the waters the whole time. And they don't care about fighting anti-Semitism. That's the reality of it. What they care about is defending Israel's genocidal policies or Israel's apartheid. So I think that we're in a very, very important moment in British history, but I think this also goes for the United States, because the conversation I'm describing, which is happening here now, also is happening in the United States in ways that it wasn't before. Like, if you look now, there's like AIPAC Tracker, there's all these groups that are coming up which are focused on exposing the Israel lobby, and people are speaking with an open chest about issues that they've been scared about for a long, long time, and that's a important thing.
Thank you very much. I'm very aware of the time, so Loki and Hoda, I want to ask you the same question, but please, can you say it briefly? What does Zionism mean to you? Let's start with Loki, please.
It's the imposition of a social arrangement on a region in which it's widely opposed. It means the war against Palestinian presence, against Lebanese sovereignty, and it's really an attempt to square a circle which cannot be squared. And also, it's an unsustainable imbalance of power.
Hoda?
Zionism means the destruction of our homes, building illegal settlements on top of our homes, massacring our people, committing genocide in Gaza, reducing our people to subjects to test weapons on, and ultimately denying us our rights to live on our land and have our freedom and our rights. And the opposite of Zionism is liberation for Palestinians, and something I look forward to the day of.
Matt, I want to ask you this question. I've been thinking a lot about, actually, some quotes that Biden said in the past and recently. The first one, he said that if there was no Israel, we will have to invent Israel so that we protect our interests in the region. And the other quote, he said, I am a Zionist. I'm not a Jew, I'm a Zionist. And I don't have to be a Jew to be a Zionist because I am a Zionist. Why do you think the U.S. supports Israel so bad, so much? What is so special about Israel?
Well, there's two arguments, isn't there? And there's a lot of people that believe both things. Like, one is that it's a imperial outpost in an oil-rich region and will help the U.S. and Britain and other allies control project power in that region. The other one is that the political systems have been captured by a very powerful and creative lobby. My sense is the latter is more true now. I think that previously, maybe the first one was the case when Israel was set up. And in fact, there's an interesting quote from him. I think his name's Ronald Storrs. He was the governor of Jerusalem in the 20s. And someone said to him, this was post the Balfour Declaration of 1917. And he was asked, why does Britain support Zionism? And he said, we want a little Jewish Ulster in a sea of potentially hostile Arabism. So Ulster being Northern Ireland, right? And his argument was, in this oil-rich region, there might arise leaders or movements that would impact our imperial operations and not allow us to control it in such a defined way. So we need this little outpost that can control and keep the area backward, essentially. Mm-hmm. They had those, the British installed a lot of the extremist dictators that rule the Gulf now, and that was the same sort of idea. We need these mafia families to just keep the oil coming to us. So how it progressed is quite interesting, because after the Second World War, President Truman recognized Israel 11 minutes after it was declared. He was the first, but the Suez Crisis, the Americans didn't support the intervention there. And Israel, I think, proved their use to the West in the Suez Crisis, because this was in 1956 when NASA nationalized the Suez Canal, and it impacted British and French investors. So the British invaded, the French invaded, and Israel invaded. They went into Sinai, and Israel was just seen as a military ally. They didn't have any interest, but they became part of it. And then I think that Israel really proved its worth after 1967 as well, and then 73, as like that we can use Israel to beat up the region. So that's the history. But I think now, and this is based a lot on actually what I've looked at looked at for Declassified UK, is we've done so much work on the Israel lobby, and it's just so extensive. The power, I've mentioned the Alan Duncan story, but there's plenty of other stories like that. And I think that now the imperial function that it performs for the US, Britain, and other European countries is not the same, and I think it might even be a hindrance. In fact, that's the argument of John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt. They wrote a book called The Israel Lobby, professors in the United States, and they say, actually, they're realists, they're not leftists, but they're looking out for US interests, and they say, actually, Israel's not in our interest to support it at all anymore, but our political system has been captured by the Israeli state, so we have to support them. And I think that is, I kind of take that view. And also, I think here, looking at the power of the Israel lobby, it's impossible for leaders to rise up because they'll get destroyed by the Israel lobby if those leaders have a pro-Palestine position. We all know what happened with Jeremy Corbyn. Jeremy Corbyn is not a radical. Like, I interviewed him the other day. I was talking to him about Palestine. He's really not a radical. He just supports a two-state solution. He's like talking to. It's definitely not like talking to us. And but he was destroyed, because even that is too much for the Israel lobby. And that was a real, real window into the power of the Israel lobby, and also a window into answering the question that I posed at the start, is it the Imperial Outpost or the lobby? I think that Corbyn proved that. I think that if someone in the US rose up, like, you look what they had done to Ilhan Omar, the congresswoman. I mean, again, she's not super radical, but she has been destroyed by the Israel lobby, or they've tried to destroy her. There was a whole scandal because she used the phrase, it's all about the Benjamins. I mean, invented scandals, but ones that work. So I think that the undying support is mainly because our political system has been captured by a hostile foreign country. And again, I use hostile on purpose, because it's not an ally. Like, although there is this intelligence relationship, which Loki mentioned, like, they're all working together. Israel does not look out for British interests at all. They don't care. And they overrule the US. Like, look at the...
Let me take this question to Loki, please. Yeah. And I'm really sorry again, because we're running out of time. Loki, since the beginning of this genocide, polls say that the majority of the British people support a ceasefire. And then we're now 9 months into this genocide. We have been seeing a lot of protests. Every Saturday, hundreds of thousands of people protest. And we all know that the majority of the British people want a ceasefire. They are not supporting the UK arms trade to Israel. But still, the UK insists, the government insists on supporting Israel with weaponry. So my question to you, are we a democracy? And do we have an independent foreign policy?
No and no. But also, there's another poll that came out that said the majority of 18 to 24-year-olds are anti-Zionists in this country. But there's something that I think could be quite illustrative of this imbalance in power with what we're talking about. There's something called the UK-Israel Tech Hub, which is staffed by former Israeli military and intelligence personnel. It's headed by a gentleman by the name of Chaim Shani, who is the former director general of the Israeli Ministry of Finance. Now, the UK-Israel Tech Hub exists in the British Embassy in Israel to obtain public sector contracts in this country for Israeli tech companies. It's funded by the British Foreign Office. It's funded by the British Embassy itself. And as I said, it's staffed by former Israeli intelligence personnel. Have you heard of any type of arrangement like that? And get this. So Chaim Shani, simultaneously the head of the UK-Israel Tech Hub, simultaneously the on the board of directors of something called Cellebrite, which is an Israeli intelligence company which hacks phones. Through the UK-Israel Tech Hub, Cellebrite got the contract from the British police to hack phones in this country. It's headed by alumni of Unit 8200 in the Israeli military. He also was a director of something called Nice Systems, which also has a contract with the British police to handle some of their investigations, and also has the contract in Scotland for the facial recognition in the CCTV. So it's a completely imbalanced relationship. You don't have the equivalent. For instance, if you look at the company that monitors the Thames water system in London, it's entirely alumni of the Talpot unit in the Israeli military. It obtains information about London's water system and then sends it to Thames Water. Can you imagine? So it sees it first. Now, I'm not saying that there's anything necessarily untoward about the operations and the monitoring of the water system. What I'm saying is, in any normal circumstances, you would not grant former agents of a foreign state that type of access to your national infrastructure. How has that happened? Why has that happened? We could go even further. What would you think if I was to tell you that the company that handles the data for the British Home Office, the British Foreign Office, the British Ministry of Defence, and the NHS offered its directorship to Benjamin Netanyahu? The same company handles the most classified data in the US military system, in the Pentagon. The company's name is Oracle. It's founded by Larry Ellison, who's the largest funder of the Friends of the IDF in the history of the charity. He funds settlements, and he's very close to Benjamin Netanyahu, and he offered him the directorship of that company. This is insane. This is insanity. Now, in the case of Matt's question that he just answered, I think the case of Jonathan Pollard needs to be known and needs to be studied, because this was an individual that was spying on the United States for Israel and was imprisoned by the United States. Now, during his imprisonment, Bill Clinton was approached by Benjamin Netanyahu and told, "We want Pollard's release, and we have information about your affair with Monica Lewinsky." This is all publicly accessible, well-documented information. At that point, Bill Clinton goes to Robert Gates, to Dick Cheney, and he says, "Look, I'm feeling quite convinced by Netanyahu's argument. I think maybe we should release Pollard." At which point, Dick Cheney, Robert Gates, and one of the other neocons that was Rumsfeld, I think, they threatened to resign. They threatened to resign. They said, "If you release Pollard, this is an affront to our sovereignty." NSA, Edward Snowden, one of the things that he revealed is that the NSA perceives Israel's surveillance and espionage in the United States as the most aggressive of all foreign actors. It's not to say they don't act hand in glove. It's not to say they don't act lock in step. It's not to say that they don't outsource services to each other. But I actually believe that in the rest of the world, there's competition that exists between the United States and between Israel in this outsourcing of data management and surveillance. You know, you've got the Moroccan external intelligence outsourcing their operations to the Israelis. The United States will not like that. They will frown upon things like that. And it's happening more and more. You know, you look at the recent revelations that came of an Israeli intelligence operation that was meddling in something like 30 elections in the continent of Africa. When you actually look at who funded the organization that revealed that, they're funded by the United States. The organization that revealed that is funded by the United States. So there is competition there. There is an antagonism that exists within that relationship in terms of that kind of stuff.
Thank you.
Hoda, if we live in a society where international law is applied and justice is applied genuinely of everyone, what do you think should happen to the ministers and politicians and leaders of political parties who supported the genocide and said Israel has the right to cut off food and water from the population of Gaza?
Well, I think first they should be fired. I just think there's absolutely no place for it in our society. And talking of politicians, actually, I thought of this when you were talking, Matt, about one example, again, of the Israel lobby, which is John Woodcock, also known as Lord Walney. And recently, he wrote a report which, amongst many things, wants Palestine Action to be banned. He wants a new, he calls it prescription light for Palestine Action. And this report came out a few weeks ago, and we were getting contacted all of a sudden. We didn't have any idea about it, by BBC, all the mainstream news places were saying, "What's your comment? What's your comment?" So the comment, and thankfully a lot of work had already been done on this man and the fact that he was funded by the Israel lobby, the fact that he was the former chair of Labour Friends of Israel, you could find that he was being paid by arms companies, including Leonardo, who we frequently target, as well as oil companies. So he had massively financial vested interests in protecting the companies and the systems that we oppose. So, and he was trying to claim to be an independent advisor. So the comment was very simple. This is what this guy is. He's a former chair of Labour Friends of Israel. He's getting paid by these companies. He is not prioritising the interests of the British people. He's protecting the interests of a genocidal entity. Did they print any of that? No. Actually, all of the different papers, I think it took the news agent's podcast, interestingly, had an interview with him, and then they mentioned it for the first time, and they said to him, Palestine Action say, like it's a massive revelation, that you were the former chair of Labour Friends of Israel, and he and you're funded by the Israel lobby. And his response was, well, that's an anti-Semitic trope. and actually, the thing is his response, it was like he was shocked. You could see he was shocked to even be asked about it. And I'm ashamed to say that I was like, I was really excited. It's just that he'd been asked about the fact that he had vested interest. And I'm ashamed of that. Not ashamed, but because our bar has become so low.
Mm.
When it comes to exposing how vested interest they do have with the Israel lobby. And these are facts. And the report was called How Groups Are Trying to Coerce Our Democracy. I mean, the irony of it, when you're funded by the Israel lobby, when you're funded by these arms companies, and you're an unelected politician, and you're trying to dictate British policy, and to say we're trying to coerce democracy. So I just thought I would end on that. Another example of the Israel lobby.
Thank you. I have one last question for you, Matt.
Okay.
Would you live in the US again?
I haven't been there for a long time. I'm too scared. What will happen to me at the border? But
I would be scared.
Yeah, there's a lot of amazing people in America, you know. I spent a lot of my 20s there. Like, it's not that they don't all support their government there. And that is, they're also erased from the media. You get like, if you watch the mainstream media there is even worse than here. Like the broadcast media, like CNN and MSNBC, it's just like literally makes you more stupid the longer you watch it. But it's got a very, very interesting, it's a very, very interesting country. It's got so many different parts to it. It's extremely diverse, people from all over the world. And I think that they are a big hope. Like, even with Palestine Action in the US, I mean, you've got amazing activists working with you guys. There's been amazing actions against arms shipments, but also, obviously, everyone knows about what's going on in college campuses.
Yeah.
Like, that is a big, big hope for all of us, because, as Huda said, they're in the belly of the beast. Like, what happens in the US is going to have a big impact on not just Palestine but the whole world. So if people are waking up there and people are actually going to take on the blob in Washington, which is the national security apparatus which runs the government, then that is a real hope for humanity. So I think that we shouldn't see Americans as enemies. We should see their government as an enemy, but we should promote and understand that there's a lot of good people and they're growing. The other thing is we've had an awakening here. And I should just finish with this. Like, Gaza has changed the world. I think it's a turning point in world history. I've never ever seen these people as awake as they are now. It's not going to go away either. I've thought this from previous massacres in Gaza in 2014, 2021, others, that things are changing. And then it did kind of go back. But this has been 8 months, and we've been watching the most horrendous stuff we've ever seen on our phones. Then looking at our TV and understanding that, okay, they're lying to us, and then looking to our mainstream politicians and say, okay, well, they support this. There's no way that's not having a generational impact here and in the United States. So we have to take advantage of that. We have to go hard out. We have to get the truth out, and we have to call out our enemies. And our enemies are not just the US government, the Israeli government, the British government. Our enemies are the mainstream media, because the mainstream media provide the cover, as you've said many times, Ahmed, for what goes on. And there is a real, real, again, it's another red line for a lot of people. People don't want to talk about the role that the media has, or at least they don't want to talk about the liberal end or the left end, like The Guardian. But they're all part of the same system, which, as Loki said, is an adjunct to the empire. And we need to create alternative institutions outside of those that can change the debate. And I'll finish with this, because it's the election, right? Look at what Nigel Farage, who obviously is a repugnant human being and with repugnant politics, but look at what he's done to British politics. He's transformed it without ever getting into power. He formed UKIP and it completely transformed the Tory party. David Cameron had to call a referendum just because otherwise he would have destroyed the Conservative Party. He's now reformed. They're now saying ahead of the Conservatives in the polls. Now, even if they're not going to form the next government, but he's transformed politics just by putting pressure on the Conservative government from the right. Why can't we do that from the left here? We have to change the Labour Party. The Labour Party is not the answer. It never was. For a moment, I thought it was, maybe with Corbyn, but they were the biggest element, or not the biggest, but one of the biggest elements in destroying Corbyn. So they're not the answer. What we need to do is create institutions, and this goes for the media too, outside of those mainstream institutions, to put pressure on them, to expose them, and expose the role they play in the imperial project that is based in Washington, D.C.
Thank you very much. So now we will have 10 minutes of Q&A from the audience.
I mean, I think South Lebanon, personally. I think Israel is trying to achieve the impossible because it has such fantastical and maximalist aims. So it's very unrealistic and idealistic in what it's trying to do. If you were to say, in order for the greater good, I want to remove 1 million people from London, how are you going to achieve that? And Herzl, in one of his early books, he writes, it's a necessity to spirit the penniless population across the border. Nourin Masalha, in the book, The Expulsion of the Palestinians, he goes in depth into, from Chaim Weizmann to others, this idea of expulsion being a necessity for the Zionist project. Frankly, when you look at the forces in the region, they were not in the state that they are in now at the time of 1948. What did you have? They had the Jordanian army that was led by Ghalib Pasha, led by the British who were working with the Israelis. What do you have now? You've got Yemen. Look at what the Yemenis have achieved. What do you have now in Lebanon? You have a real fighting force that Israel is scared to go to war with, that 100,000 Israelis from the north are currently displaced, some of them even in camps, since the month of October. Not enough is actually so much of the way that we, and I understand why, in this country discuss Zionism and Palestine. It focuses on Israel's power, you know, and I say that as someone who's spent a lot of the last hour talking about the Israel lobby here, but not enough is actually focused on where Israel is weak vis-a-vis the regional situation. I wouldn't want to be a Zionist in that situation. I wouldn't want to have to try and solve that issue. And like I say, they're very reluctant. I mean, Benny Gantz has been issuing threats to Lebanon relentlessly since October. Why hasn't he followed through? Because he knows that he's not fighting children. He's not going to be killing children. You look at what has been achieved in the targeting of key intelligence installations, from the Miran base to others in North Palestine, in occupied North Palestine. Israel has been rendered blind on the northern front. And that has been through extremely well thought out and strategic activity. There's a whole other question. The Zionists want to erase and demolish Al-Aqsa. That was in many ways the basis of the start of this, Tawfan al-Aqsa, is because there's a clarity. There's no clarity in this country, not in the Muslim community, not in other communities, about what the actual equation around al-Aqsa is, what the Zionist intention with al-Aqsa is, the extent to which those aspects of the Zionist movement who view the destruction of al-Aqsa and the building of a temple as an existential necessity, the realization is not here in this society, but in the region it's there.
Mm.
In the region it's there. So if you're Israel, you have two things that you must achieve in the next 10 years. You must stop South Lebanon. You must take out that fighting force. You can't and you won't. You must destroy Al-Aqsa and build a temple. That sounds like a completely impossible objective. How are they going to achieve that? It's a problem for them to solve. But, you know, I'm sure the British and the US government will be finding ways to assist them in that.
Can we have another question there?
No. I think that it's interesting you mentioned World in Action because my mentor and a wonderful journalist called Gavin McFadgen, he was a senior figure in that for many years. He did amazing documentaries, and that was on mainstream TV. But I talked to him, he died in 2016, but I was talking to him before he died, and he was saying the mainstream is transformed from when I was around, which is strange, right? Because you would have thought, I still don't quite understand this, but you would have thought with the democratization of the media, which has happened with social media, the internet, the declassified can exist, electronic intifada, mint press. Like, we couldn't have existed 20 years ago or 25 years ago. But you would have thought the pressure that would put on the mainstream is they'd have to open up a bit, otherwise they get outflanked. But the opposite has happened. The mainstream's become much more constricted. Look at some of the amazing reporters from that era, it's like Seymour Hersh, John Pilger, who died recently. John Pilger was writing on his website, and Seymour Hersh was writing on Substack. The mainstream has become completely constricted, so I think that it was never great, but it's even worse now. And I think that and this is a question I get quite a lot: is it worth trying to change them? No, they're structurally set up to support the system. Because they're all the same people. This is what I try and tell people about the Guardian, right? Like, if you hate the Labour Party, you hate the Guardian because they're all the same people. You basically, if the Labour Party was a newspaper, it would be the Guardian. So it's true, and they kind of like follow, they kind of follow each other politically. And we need to create our own institutions. It's a long term project. That's what's quite scary for a lot of people, I think, or not scary, but is quite daunting because. We're talking about generational project. Like, well, we were talking actually before we came up about the left media before, during the Corbyn period, right? And you had like the Canary and Electronic Intifada, which did all the important work on the Israel lobby during that period. But it wasn't big enough. The infrastructure wasn't there to really support Corbyn. There was no infrastructure. He was kind of a lone figure. Just getting absolutely battered. And the next time, if we ever get that opportunity again, we need to have the infrastructure in place, which is going to take a long time to support that figure who is outside the mainstream, the political figure. That goes for media institutions. I think it goes for political institutions and others. So, and it's happening. Like, I've been very, I spent a lot of my youth, like, really bored by politics here. And actually, in terms of alternative media, we got some of the most exciting, organizations around, like Palestine Deep Dive, who organized this, is amazing. Double Down News, Electronic Intifada, Declassified UK, there's loads now. And actually, it's quite interesting with I bought out a book last year about corporations. I didn't get one mention in the mainstream media, but it sold really well because I went to all the alternative media and did promo stuff. And you couldn't have done that 5 years ago. So we're building it, and it is hopeful. So I think that's the way. I just wanted to come back to your question quickly as well, because I think Loki dealt with the problems they've got in the region, which are real, yes. But they've also got problems in the societies of their patrons. Like, look it is historic what's happening in the United States on the campuses. They haven't seen that kind of mobilization since the Vietnam War, and you're talking about a society. In the Vietnam War, all their parents, their friends and parents were getting sent off to war. So in Israel-Palestine, they're not even directly connected to the issue, yet and their media is just feeding them untold nonsense, and yet they're still rising up on a mass level, and they must be freaking out in Tel Aviv about that. And that, and what they're doing is what they're doing here to Palestine Action and others, is trying to criminalize dissent against Israel. They're destroying democracy on behalf of Israel, or whatever exists of democracy in this country. I don't like using the term democracy, unqualified, but and that contradiction can't last, because if you've got a population which is aware of what's happening and doesn't support the government policy, and the government unwilling to change, and the and both mainstream parties supporting that policy, that contradiction cannot continue forever. At some stage, there's going to be a reckoning, and I think that's hopeful. So there is, they have a lot of problems, and I think they, as Loki said, I think they've overreached. They are drunk on their own power. They've been given a free ride for so long, they've stopped being able to analyze the situation in a rational way. They're just they're acting in a completely irrational way. And Ilan Pappe actually was interviewed the other day, and he said he thinks this is the end stage of Zionism. And he's someone who would know.
We have another question here.
No. I mean, I think quite the opposite. I think it's quite telling that Elbit saw fit to have its offices in Keir Starmer's constituency. He completely, as far as we could tell, supported that and supported Elbit Systems. But, you know, Palestine Action was relentless in our campaign against them, and we did force them out of their office, as we have done in other factories across England. And actually, I want to bring that back to your question, because for me, I think the Achilles heel and the weakness is as the people, and how we harness our strength, and that we have to find the Achilles heel wherever we are. And so for me, I see it as I'm a part of this country, I'm living in this country, this is where I can have influence and make change. And so in the context of living in the imperial core and looking at Elbit Systems, which is such a key part of the apparatus of the Israeli military, it really is their weakness. You know, you wouldn't think an Israeli weapons factory, what they call their defense firm, could be constantly attacked by Palestine Action. You know, we've been going at this now for 4 years, it will be next month. And just today, or last night, or this morning, however you classify it, 20 people breached the security of Elbit's highly secure, their most secure business compound in this country, in Kent. They cut through three different security fences. They got through inside the Elbit factory, and they destroyed that factory. That happened this... And extend that applause for the people who are inside police cells right now for taking that action. But that really shows that it is us who have the power. And if we want to get rid of every single one of their factories and the Zionist institutions, it is in our power to do it.
One last question.
So a lot of what we understand to be structures of solidarity in this country received a turbo boost of funding and personnel in the aftermath of Oslo. Mm-hmm. So what you had set up was a system that has baked into it a certain level of normalization and a compass of discussion which revolves around international law, which is based on lobbying the governments where those organizations exist. So that became the function of, we're talking post-Oslo, that became the function of Palestinian solidarity organizations in this country. The orientation was towards lobbying the British government to start caring about international law. And this same song has been sung for several decades. But if you actually examine the region and things that are being said by people there, then you have a completely different conception of what's actually happening. The
the main focus of international law and lobbying governments. It allows for a kind of paternalistic British thing to happen. It's not massively consequential, to be completely honest. And Palestine Action with direct militancy has achieved so much in these few years, where that particular model of lobbying on the basis of international law didn't achieve much for those several decades. So the other issue is a kind of knee-jerk instinctive liberalism that says, I mean, people don't even want to sit next to Jackie Walker or me. What makes you think they want to sit anywhere near any type of effective resistance force? That's off the basis of the smear factory. So that fear and that liberal instinct is what will push towards that kind of stuff. And also, it's essentially a form of McCarthyism that says these are the parameters of what is permissible pro-Palestinian talk. Palestine Action is considered before it was spoken about by Jonathan Woodcock as an extremist organization. It was denounced as an extremist organization by the very most mainstream. It was interacted with as an extremist organization. It was lobbied against more fiercely by the pro-Palestinian movement domestically and internationally than it was lobbied against by the Israelis. Do you understand what I'm saying? That Palestine Action was lobbied against more ferociously by pro-Palestinian organizations that started before the Israelis started. We were blacklisted by pro-Palestinians before we were blacklisted by the Israelis. And, you know, and if you study Wadi Haddad, you study the process that played out around that kind of stuff, you start to understand that it's about proximity to the acceptable center, which can arrive at some form of political solution or benefit. These are the irrationalized. These are the people that are nowhere near any type of political settlement. But actually, that doesn't exist without that. And the benefits, the same way, you don't get a plethora of jobs that were set up in the youth sector alone in London without riots in Brixton, without riots in Bristol, without riots throughout the country. Because then there is the need to try and placate that energy. And so the gains that happen in the acceptable political center cannot happen without the pressure from the irrational outside.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Can I add to that? I think it's a very, very important point, because normalization is everywhere within the pro-Palestine movement itself. And it's it's very, very hard. Again, it's like many, many red lines, but this one is one people don't want to touch, because we're talking about institutions which we're meant to revere as pro-Palestinian. Recently I was looking at Medical Aid for Palestine, Palestinians, mm-hmm. which is obviously a good organization, does good work. But I was looking into a little bit into them after their CEO, mm-hmm. Melanie Ward, is now running to be a Labour MP under Keir Starmer, and this is a party which has supported the genocide for 8 months. So I started looking at them, and I looked into what are they doing? And it was quite interesting, because in 2018, they invited Jess Phillips, when she was a Labour friend of Israel, and a bunch of other MPs to visit Israel and the West Bank. And now those tours are very, very a window into how this whole system operates, because what they do is they go to the West Bank and they see some bad stuff that the Israelis have done, but then they go back to Israel and they get talked to by the foreign minister, a spokesman for the foreign ministry, a retired Supreme Court judge, Israeli Supreme Court judge, someone from the Palestinian Authority. And essentially what all those institutions are about is to normalize what they've seen and say, well, it's bad, isn't it, what's happening? We're trying to get around it. There's a peace process, this kind of stuff. And those MPs imbibe that whole system, and the whole system is set up for that. The Palestinian Authority, we should talk about as well, because it's a key part of that. Loki talks about Oslo. Oslo was all about this normalization. It was. Why do you think there's no resistance or very, very little resistance in the West Bank now? Because the PA was set up in Oslo to contain Palestinian resistance. And that's why they want the PA. The US wants the PA running Gaza, because they want the Palestinians subjugated. And I think, it goes across the pro-Palestinian community. And that's why there's a lot of animosity towards Palestine Action and stuff, because they go over that they're doing stuff. They've had an impact. You've talked about a pro-Palestinian movement in this country that's been operating for decades, and then these guys come along in 2020 and literally make material gains for the cause and transform the situation, and yet people are attacking them. It makes no sense to me, but it does make sense if you understand that those NGOs are kind of set up to keep the whole thing on life support, you know, to keep the peace process going, to keep the whole facade. And then you never have to have the difficult conversations. You still get the funders coming in. So we need to blow up that system and create a new one, which is predicated on liberation, not palliative care for Palestinians.
We're 9:08, so thank you very much, everyone.